Hello, Ali. How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited for this week's book, Nicholas Nickleby.
Me too. The third book by Charles Dickens, is that right?
Yep, the third book by Charles Dickens, released periodically, like all others, between 1838 and 1839.
What do you think of it?
I really like this book. I think it's very telling about his relationship with his mother. There's the character of Mrs. Nickleby, Nicholas's mother, who's this kind of sort of comic relief and slightly dim-witted woman who is very impressed by fancy men with titles. And she's based on Charles Dickens' mum. And she didn't recognise herself in the writing. She actually said that, like, she could barely believe that anybody would ever be that way and there would never be such a woman that existed. So he kind of got away with that. More horrible literary revenge from Dickens.
Yeah, it's that definitely sounds like it's a very revelatory theme of the book. It's his third novel, so it's one of the early ones. I really like it as well. I actually think it's interesting that it's not normally put on the same pedestal as you know, the big three, the Olivers, the Christmas Carols, and the Great Expectations, because I think where this novel is light and comic, it's really, really light and comic, and where it's dark, it's really, really dark. We'll come on to that at a later stage. But I think it's a great story, and it's nice. You know, I mean, I speak as someone who is 33. It's nice to, you know, have a protagonist that you feel like you can relate to a bit more than the Pips and the Olivers and the David Copperfields, you know, these little 10-year-old boys. It's nice to have someone who's a grown man.
Yeah, at the beginning of the novel, he's 19 years old. So you are right, you're starting with a slightly older character for once. A lot of this book is set at the beginning, is set at this horrible boarding school, Dotheby's Hall. I listened to an American calling it Do the Boys, and it took me forever to figure out what they were talking about. What is Do the Boys? And I was like, oh my God, they mean Dotheby's.
Yeah, but maybe that was deliberate. I mean, the stuff that they were doing in that school is not, you know, it's so disgusting that maybe there was a little angle there.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it is actually based on real Yorkshire boarding schools. So in early 1838, Dickens and Hablot Brown, who was his illustrator for this book, a little side note here is that the illustrator decided to give himself a nickname Fizz, because he thought it went quite nicely with Dickens's pen name Boz. So you had Fizz and Boz, which to me sounds like Bill and Ben.
It's like two Cartoon Network characters, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Fizz, closest Boz to Yorkshire.
Yeah, Fizz and Boz in Yorkshire. Yeah, so they went and visited a real boarding school. It was the headmaster, William Shaw, ran this place called Bowes Academy. And he'd actually been prosecuted for neglect because two pupils had become blind because of the beatings and poor nutrition that they'd got. And by the time that Dickens and Fizz got there, it was slightly better. But I mean, it was still pretty horrific conditions. And at least one student a year was sort of expected to die from appalling conditions. So you can see why Dickens kind of wrote about how horrible this was. It was real and it was happening, and very similar. He always likes to expose injustices of children, doesn't he?
Yeah, I couldn't believe this. I'm reading this great book at the moment called The Artful Dickens by John Mullen, who, you know, which I really would recommend to people, where it explains this very thing. And I read the book and I just thought, it's almost sort of concentration camp level, what's going on in this school. It's not like anything we've ever seen. It is so horrific, the things that are going on, that I put this down as, okay, this is Dickens, you know, character writing, exaggerating for effect, and, you know, doing the things that we spoke about before, where the bad people become really bad and the good people become really good. But you're absolutely right. If we're to believe the accounts, there was a man called Shaw who did this to children, and he saw it. So, you know, one wonders whether this was the moment, perhaps, when Dickens actually suddenly, you know, the penny drops on the injustice of children for the first time when he saw this, because it's just absolutely, absolutely awful. And we should talk a bit more about some of the facts. Like, what other stuff have we found?
Well, it's interesting you say it's like the first time the penny drops for him seeing the injustice in children, because I think for a lot of it was very much in his previous books and later books that he writes, it's very much first-hand experience of like the injustice he experienced as a child, whereas I think this is him seeing it happening to other children, and it's not just his own personal experience. So one of the main characters in this book, Smike, Dickens actually took the name from a tombstone from one of the boys that he saw in the grounds of visiting this boarding school, Bowes, in Yorkshire. So he literally took the name of a dead child that he saw, and then he made it into one of the characters.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, it's crazy. I think it's just such a kind of, yeah, I think that. I think certainly in terms of his attitudes towards injustice, this was definitely a moment which was a big revelatory moment for him. I mean, there's all these kind of accounts, aren't there, about how bad or good the bootblacking factory was. And I don't think we've had any evidence about what happened behind closed doors. There are some people that think that maybe something awful happened to him, whether someone kind of did something horrific to him. But I think certainly this is something which, yeah, throws us into a kind of big, crazy thing. And it's just awful. Should we do the synopsis?
Yes, let's hear the plot.
Right, here we go. After the death of his father, Nicholas and his sister Kate are forced to leave their comfortable home life in Devonshire and seek the aid of their only living relative, Ralph Nickleby. A cruel man, Ralph takes an immediate dislike to Nicholas and forces him to take a low-paid job at Dotheboys Hall under the horrifically cruel Mr. Squeers, who beats and tortures the boys, including Smike, who is his slave boy and who he forces to do all of the chores. It quickly becomes clear to Nicholas that Squeers is running a scam where he takes boys in, pretending they are going somewhere nice to learn to be gentlemen. He treats them horrifically and uses the money sent by their parents for himself and his family. Nicholas only stays at this place because he's essentially blackmailed by his uncle, and he wants to make sure his mother and sister are cared for by his uncle. Smike, one night, tries to escape and is captured by Squeers and beaten, and Nicholas steps in to defend Smike and beat Squeers, and the two escape to leave for London. A clerk of Ralph, called Newman Noggs, shows Nicholas a letter that the Squeerses have written to Ralph, which exaggerate how Nicholas beat him. And Ralph tells the family he will cut their allowances as long as Nicholas is living with them. Now, Nicholas's sister Kate, meanwhile, is being sexually harassed by these two horrible men who Ralph wants to go into business with, and Nicholas steps in to protect her after hearing about this. Ralph grows an increasing hatred and frustration of his nephew and retaliates by a failed attempt to kidnap Smike and return him to the Squeerses. Smike luckily escapes, and Nicholas sends him and his family to Devonshire, where Smike sadly later dies. It later transpires that Smike is the son of Ralph, who he thought to be dead. In his grief of learning of his son's death, Ralph hangs himself. In the midst of all of this, Nicholas has been in love with a girl called Madeline, who is betrothed to an older man who is willing to pay off her family debt. The book concludes with her fiancé dying hours before their wedding, her family debt paid off, and Nicholas free to marry her.
So again, we have a Dickens book with lots of coincidence and lots of nicely tied ends.
Yeah, I mean, it really is such a rollercoaster ride, isn't it? And there's so many things to talk about, and I guess the characters are so juicy, aren't they? Like, we've spoken a bit about him already, but this character of Squeers, I just found so evil and so deliciously painted. You know, the first time we meet him, you know, Nicholas has gone to meet his uncle, and his uncle says to him, "What are you doing? And why, you know, what are you? You fit young man, you should be out working. Have you done anything for your family? Why don't you take a job?" So he encourages him to take this low paid job at this place called Dotheboys Hall. And we meet Squeers, and Squeers is just putting on this lovely little portrait of someone who's really friendly to the boys in front of their parents. And he says, "You know, it's going to be a great fun. We're going to come, we're going to educate you." And the moment the parents leave, he drops that act and turns into basically a torturer. And we should talk a bit about his family. Who have we got in his family?
Oh, his horrible, horrible wife.
Horrible wife, who's just awful. Probably even worse than him in a way, because she's never nice. At least there's moments where he's a bit angelic, even if it's an act.
I don't know what's worse, feigned kindness or just outright deliberate cruelty. I'd rather know where I stand and have just know that somebody is constantly cruel instead of somebody pretending to be nice and ripping the rug from beneath you.
Yeah, I don't think either are particularly good, but I think certainly, lesser of two evils. We've then got his daughter, who is called Fanny Squeers, who there's this thread of the narrative where she fancies Nicholas. So when Nicholas starts teaching the boys, she goes all goggly-eyed and gooey over him and goes to kind of look through the window and spy on his lessons and goes all kind of fangirly. And then she does this thing where she goes into his lesson, drops and pretends to be delivering something, or I can't remember exactly what you probably remember it, but she kind of goes, oh, have I come in here to drop a pen off or something? And she says, do you know where my father is? And he says, I think he's out. And she goes, oh, stands there really awkwardly. Becomes clear that Nicholas doesn't return the same affection that she's returning to him. And then she ends up hating him and basically just becoming really, really horrible, which she is anyway. But when she realizes that she's not going to be romantically linked with Nicholas, she, doesn't respond well to that, does she?
No, it is a very obvious writing of a woman's scorned, isn't it?
It's just awful. And and then she does this thing where she realizes that Nicholas isn't going to return her affections. So she takes it out on this boy, Smike, who is a kind of crippled boy. He's quite clearly, suffering enormously from malnutrition. And when we see him, when we come across him in the novel and we see him in the film, you look at him and he's clearly just being abused and beaten on a regular basis. And there's a fragility to the character where it just looks like he's constantly on this knife edge of at any point, he could just be in real serious trouble. And he's just bullied by the family. By the son, the horrible son. He reminds me a bit of like Dudley Dursley. So when it becomes clear that Nicholas isn't returning that affection to Fanny, she takes it out on Smike and just starts bullying him, I think probably to provoke Nicholas or to try and get some reaction out of him. But Smike, I love. I've never felt such an emotional protection over a character. And actually, do you know what we talk a lot about in previous podcasts? We spoke a bit about Oliver, and I remember we were both saying that he was a bit wet and a bit soppy, and a lot of these protagonists are quite vanilla. But I do really like Nicholas Nickleby as a character. I like his bravery, and I like the fact that he just doesn't care, and just he'll always act on what he thinks is the right thing, and he just doesn't. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think he has a very set moral code. He does struggle with it, obviously. You see that when he's at the school and Smike is being abused, he really struggles with, if he doesn't stay at this school and he doesn't do his job that he's been sent there to do by his Uncle Ralph, his mother and his sister are going to be, he doesn't know exactly, but he knows that, they're not going to be taken care of. The threat that their welfare is constantly over his head as long as he stays there. But I think at the end of the day, the death of children is so big, and the weight of that, the pressure of that is too much. So he has to put the children's welfare over the comfort, essentially, of his sister and his mother. And that is a big character choice that he's written there, that actually he's putting children ahead of his family. Sometimes water is thicker than blood, almost. He's putting somebody else ahead of his own family, and it's a very deliberate, conscious choice, isn't it, as a writer, to say that actually sometimes you must do the right thing, not the thing that makes it easier for your family and for your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, maybe perhaps when Charles, they're becoming the same person. But when they did visit Yorkshire for this bit of, research, location scouting, maybe he did have that reaction. Maybe he did think, this is, if I was in this situation, if I was living this reality, I would stay up here and help these boys rather than my own family. And that's where, that's the part of the ship that I would jump to, Maybe it's kind of what he would want to do in that situation.
Apart from he didn't, he just went home and wrote a book about it. He saw them for 2 days and then was like, no, actually, do you know what? I'll just write a book.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sellout. Complete sellout.
So one of the big themes in this book is death. It's a massive driving force. It kicks the book off with the death of Nicholas's father, forcing the story to start and making Nicholas have to look for work, which is why he then ends up at the boarding school. And then we have the children who are, you know, being starved to death and beaten to death at the school. And we've just talked about that with like how he has to choose the comfort of his mother and sister or the children's lives. And then that really drives the story forwards again, because he's just like, actually, no, I don't choose death for these children, and not especially for this little boy, and takes him away from the boarding school. And then it's very sad because then you have Smike dying, which is also pushing the story forwards again. And then towards the end of the book, it's sort of like this character of death. It sort of does like a 180 and sort of is like, okay, I've been terrible and causing everything to start. And now I'm going to finish everything and tie it up all nicely. So death sort of like comes in again and kills Madeline's fiance, the woman who Nicholas is in love with, hours before their wedding and after her family debt has been paid off. So he's suddenly freed by death to marry the girl of his dreams. And then all of the sort of antagonists in this novel are then also sort of like killed off one by one in various different ways, with the main one, Ralph, the uncle, committing suicide after he learns that Smike is also dead. So it's a huge character. It's like another character in this book, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is definitely a lot of death, and it's there's not really much to say about it. Then a lot of people die, I suppose. But it's a fascinating, yeah, story. And interestingly, that we then have this strange departure, which I think we're going to speak about with our guest. But we go to Portsmouth. They decide to go to Portsmouth, and they meet this troupe of actors. Now, Portsmouth is obviously where Charles Dickens is from. It's where he spent his early childhood. His first part of his life was in Portsmouth. And I'm always so interested about why writers make certain decisions and why they decide to place things in certain geographical points. And it's so random. It's like this little island of the story. And it's a moment of lightness. They go and meet this group of actors. Smike suddenly becomes really happy. They get involved in amateur dramatics. They're playing characters in Romeo and Juliet. They're putting on performances. Smike really finds happiness for the first time. And I think this moment is key, because Smike, before leaving, says, I don't think I'll ever be happy. I don't think there's any hope for me. And Nicholas says there is hope. And they finally find this hope, I guess, this version of a heaven. So, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, as to why Charles Dickens chooses for them to meet actors specifically at this point, and also why he chooses Portsmouth. It maybe is that he has a very fond memory of Portsmouth.
Yeah, and you know, later on in his life, he becomes an actor and starts performing all of his own works as well as other plays that he's in. So it always feels, when you're reading his books, that it's very personal, and the things that make the characters happy are always the things that make Charles Dickens happy. It's not like it's going to be something like, oh, I love bird watching, because it doesn't interest him. It's always very much on a personal level. He enjoys the theatre and acting, so the character, the protagonist, will also love that.
And I think also it's about imagination and it's about escapism. And this idea that Smike has constantly, I suppose, been wanting to escape, wanting to live in this other world, this horrible, cruel reality of his circumstance. And suddenly he finds a group of people who share that similar escapism. A group of like-minded people who want to believe that there's this other place. It's a really funny scene where I'm sure you've come across a few of these people in your career, where where they're performing Romeo and Juliet, and there's a character who takes huge offence to the fact that Nicholas has been cast as Romeo, believing that he himself should be the romantic lead, and he gets very, very angry about it. Have you come across any actors like that in your time?
I can't think of any, Jimmy. Can you? I can't think of any actors who think that they should be the handsome lead.
I love this. Yeah, I can't think of anyone. I'm racking my brains. It's really hard. Yeah. Yeah. Can we just put on the record here that Ali's not talking about me, by the way? I just want to make sure.
No, you're a director, so it's definitely not me.
We know we have someone in mind, but it's not me. So it's all me. Just because if you're listening to this on audio, you would think it was me. What happens next in the story? His sister's being preyed on by these horrible guys, isn't she?
Yeah, so I was going to say, we should really talk about Kate. This is actually quite interesting that we have this core storyline which involves a woman, which is quite rare in Dickens's books. They're normally like, you know, the horrible older women or the love interest, and that's kind of it. This sister character, obviously Dickens was obsessed with his sister in real life. You know, he said that when he died he wanted to be buried beside her. There is a lot to unpack there, which unfortunately we don't have time for, but in this novel we see that sort of sisterly affection quite a lot. So his sister Kate is sort of forced to be the companion of this like horrible older woman who's very wealthy, and she's being sort of leched upon by these two older men who are sort of the associates of her uncle Ralph. And it's pretty much implied that she's expected to marry one of these men. She doesn't have any voice or any choice about what is going to happen to her, which was pretty standard for the time. And Nicholas's mother and the older lady, the companion that she's friends with, they don't see how awful these men are because they're just so enamored by their title and their status and their money. And they think that because they are wealthy and, you know, of importance to society, that that makes them good gentlemen. Whereas Kate really sees them for what they really are, like horrible, creepy men who she's terrified of being trapped with. So it's really showing the contrast sort of like between like how people were perceived and how people really were. And I find that really interesting that you see the honest view through Nicholas's sister. Like she is the one with like the true eyes, I suppose.
Yeah, I completely agree, and it's such a it is so interesting, isn't it, that you know, the love of his sister does shine through in these stories. That protection that he clearly had of her was there, and it's the first time that really we have it's a fascinating shade of the character that we're allowed to see. But when this awful thing happens to her, where this guy and his friend attempt to force themselves on Kate, there's an element of tenderness from Ralph. There's a moment where she comes out and Ralph feels like he wants to be nice to her. And he sort of says, you know, he shows some warmth to her. But ultimately, this is a wonderful moment of character writing where a character finds themselves in the fight or flight situation. You know, this is the ultimate cliffhanger of, are you a good person or a bad person? Ralph has a business arrangement with these two men that he doesn't want to lose. So despite the fact that his niece is being sexually harassed and basically borderline raped, he chooses to ignore it and continues his relationship with the men. And that ultimately is what makes him a bad man, I suppose. And I love those moments with characters where they get given an ultimatum and they have to jump one way or the other. And I suppose that's his.
Yeah, and I think what's quite sad about the situation is that it really does apply to today still. You have this like young girl being preyed on by like wealthy older men, and she's in a very difficult position where it's very hard for her to say no. And it just seems to be like a tale as old as time, doesn't it? Like, it doesn't matter if it was like set back in, you know, Dickens's time or whether it's today, these things keep happening. And she's being pimped out by her uncle pretty much, and nothing has really changed. And I think that is why I love talking about these books with you so much, is that like all of these themes that we discuss, even though the circumstances are slightly different, the key issues are still so relevant.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And you know, we've done Shakespeare now and we've done Dickens, and I think the difference between the two, I think that we found, is that the difference is not in human behavior. The difference is just in description. I think certainly the motivations of the characters are there, and they are real. And that's what makes them such wonderful characters.
Now we have a actor joining us today who, in her production of Nicholas Nickleby, had to do multi rolling because there are so many characters in every single Dickens book. Shall we introduce her?
Yes, we shall. Our guest today has performed in theatres such as the National Theatre, the Royal Opera House, and the Almeida Theatre. She has also performed in productions such as A Midsummer Night's Dream, A Flea in Her Ear, A Slice of Saturday Night, and of course, Nicholas Nickleby. Welcome to the show, Lisa Chu.
Hello.
Hi. Hello. Thank you so much for joining us and talking about your production of Nicholas Nickleby. Obviously, a lot of it is set at a horrible, horrible boarding school. And we were just wondering, if you were naughty at school, and if you were, what was the worst punishment you ever had?
I think the worst punishment I had at school was being sent to the head teacher's office and got detention. I think that's the main, like, the baddest thing I've done at school. I'm pretty, actually was quite good in a way. I didn't really do anything naughty. I was pretty a sensible kid. But I did obviously have, you know, being a teenager, you do, you know, go a bit more rebellious. But yeah, I think the most I did was, yeah, I've been sent to the head teacher, got detention. So my lunch break was kind of like shortened. I was a bit bummed out about that.
So you did this production many years ago now. This would have been about 12 years ago, am I right?
Yeah, 2009. Quite long.
Well, do you tell us about it?
Yeah, so I did it during my time at university. And we actually performed it at the Everyman Studio in Cheltenham to a, you know, a public audience. I played various characters, Fanny Squeers, Mr. Vichy, Billings, which is one of the children, the boy's kid in Yorkshire, and the young fiancé, which in the TV and movie productions, you don't really see, you know, the young fiancé and some of the characters like Mrs. Snevici, which is part of the actors' troupe. Performed it in the Everyman Studio. And yeah, it was quite enjoyable because you don't really get to see a lot of Nicholas Nickleby done in, you know, in stage, especially, you know, it's all a lot of TV and more film based.
Yeah. You you said that you played quite a few different characters. I feel like anytime we talk to an actor who's done an adaptation for stage, they have to, because there's so many characters in Dickens. Out of the many, many characters you played, did you have a favourite?
Yeah, I actually enjoyed Fanny Squeers, as you can imagine, because she's such a spoiled brat of a character. And she goes through a lot of emotions during, you know, the novel where, you know, she was over flirtatious with Nicholas, like, oh, really, you know, I'm in love with him. And she goes beyond, you know, extremely, you know, going to the point she just wants to, like, you know, I want you to love me. Okay, in a way, like a puppy, like they would want their, you know, parent to love them so much, like smother them, to the point she gets rejected so hard, and obviously sees the jealous rage from her and her friend Matilda. So you get to really play the range of emotions with Fanny, and you can really just go for it with her character, how she can just be so disgusting, like her parents. And to the point she could be so heartbroken, she could be so melodramatic with her and really just get into them emotions, especially physically and mentally as well with her. So you can just be so, I don't think you get the opportunity, especially with, you know, TV and film, and there's some plays you don't get to be so obnoxious like she is. So yeah, it was really fun playing her.
Yeah, she has that wonderful moment, doesn't she, where she, it, like you say, everything's so big, isn't it? She's suddenly in love with Nicholas, absolutely obsessed with him, goes and gets all giggly with him. And then the moment she realises that he's not, you know, doesn't have that same emotion to her, she hates him and she absolutely wants him wiped off the earth.
There's like one point where she like despises him because I think her and Tilda like kind of make up. And then she's like, no, I hate him. I don't want him. I hate him. I'm not in love with him. She sees him. She's like, oh my God, I love him. And just pretends, you know, to faint. I'm like, oh God, please, Nicholas, help me. You know, to like one extreme to the other. She's just like, then type of people. She's like, I hate them. I hate them. But then when next minute they get just swayed by love and clouded by everything and just go, no, I do. I actually am in love with them.
We would, speaking on previous episodes about what sequels would be like in stories, like what sort of person would Oliver be like if he grew up after his awful childhood? What do you think Nicholas would be like? I mean, he's obviously a bit older than Oliver, but if there was a sequel of Nicholas Nickleby, how do you envisage his life, the rest of his life, panning out?
I see him, because the way he is as a character, and he's such a family-orientated person. So I see him living at his family home still in Devonshire with, you know, his wife and his two kids, and I think he adopted a dog as well. you know, a sort of like, you know, resemblance of like Smike. So I see it's like a connection to it, like a man's best friend. I think he has more of like an easygoing life. But then I think he gets called back to London because Kate now lives there. She's married to one that took him in as a clerk, who's a clerk for one of the family members there. And I think something happens, as always with Nicholas, that he always comes to the rescue, helping Kate or one of his family members. There's a venture back in London. I think he gets called back to Portsmouth again to be like, can you do one last show for us with the Crummies? Like a massive extravaganza. And I think he goes back to, and actually performs at the Drury Lane and gets that one last opportunity to perform on stage in a really bigger audience. And I think that'd be the end of Nicholas pre-sequel.
I love that. And I love how many like journeys he makes in that version. It wouldn't be Dickens without like a long journey back to London or a long journey to Portsmouth somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. He's just always traveling everywhere. Yorkshire, Portsmouth, London, back to Portsmouth, back to London. Then now he's in like East London.
So one of the main themes that we've been talking about is like what makes a gentleman in this book. And obviously, it's very different to what it is now. And just wondering, what do you think the qualities are that make a modern gentleman today?
I think a modern gentleman, I think there are certain values, especially the Victorian gentleman has certain values to this era where I'm pretty old school. And I like, you know, for me, if it was for a gentleman, is to be open-minded and see everyone as equal and give everyone respect, equality, always respect your elders. That's how I've been taught. So I think that's always a great trait to have as a modern gentleman. And just not being judgmental of anyone's, you know, sexuality, gender, Asianism, you know, gender fluidity, whoever they are, basically, and respect everyone. I think, like, if you're homeless, you know, middle class, lower class, upper class, I think everyone should be respected as the same.
When you talk about those qualities of a modern gentleman, do you think Nicholas, the character, would have upheld that in this day and age?
I think, yeah, in a way. He is really passionate. He believes, he sees everyone is equal because he is a gentleman and was brought up as a gentleman. And he saw everyone equal, especially when he was in Yorkshire with the kids. And with Smike especially, who was obviously had disabilities, and he saw Smike as just, you know, a human being, not an animal, as the Squeers family did. And, you know, with the Crummies, he was really respectable. He even thanked them for taking him in and hospitality they gave. And just really thankful as well for, you know, everybody who's attended and also is there for his family, no matter what. If there's an issue, he's there for them, like a click of a finger. So I do see him as like a model gentleman.
What character do you relate to most in the story, do you think?
I
please don't say Fanny Squeers.
Imagine that.
It would be Squeers.
It would be Squeers, you know, the father. No. I saw myself as more Vincent Crummies, which is the father of the head of the actors troupe. He's really passionate for his art and everything. He loves his family really dearly, but he does seek a quiet life in the future and he wants more for his family. And what I read part of the book is that he actually does venture to America and does become successful there. So obviously that latter part would be amazing.
Got your eye on pilot season.
Absolutely, there I am. COVID-19. Well, COVID will hopefully be gone 2022. I'm there, pilot season. But I do have that same value as Vincent Crummies has, where he's very loyal to his family, really passionate for his art. And yeah, I do seek a quiet life in the near future, just to have my family and just relax and not to live like a fast pace anymore, and just, you know, enjoy every second, every moment, and have just a quiet zen life, really.
Mm. Yeah, that sounds like the perfect answer. I don't think there's anybody else. Jimmy, who would you be?
Oh, definitely Squeers. I'd be the guy, the director of the actors, like that guy that lives in his own world and Brummels, you know, completely all over the place and in a dream world, you know, who runs the actors troupe in Portsmouth. I think
same,
I'd be
same
here.
As you,
that's the same with me, Vincent. Yeah, Crummies.
Yeah.
That's what Lisa just said.
Is that?
He really is in his own dream world.
He is in his own dream world. I'd be him, definitely. I think, yeah, he's just so charming, isn't he? But what interesting question is, why do you think it is that Dickens chooses for those people to be a group of actors? Because it's quite random, isn't it? It's like an island. It's like him and Smike go to Portsmouth. They join an actors troupe, and then they leave, and then the story continues, and there's no kind of connection between that and the rest of the story. Why do you think it is that that Dickens chooses for them to meet a group of actors doing a play?
So I actually researched about this when I was, you know, performing it, the show, because we always had to look back why, you know, certain scenes were, you know, vital, especially. I think with the dance, with the actors troupe, not dance, the actors troupe is due to, because he was heavily influenced off stage. So his father actually exposed Charles into pantomime. I think Charles was actually so fascinated with performing and actually saw the stage as like a, you know, a magical world, really. Even though back in the day, you can imagine it wasn't as glamorous as it is right now, but it's a bit more dirty and a bit more, they saw actors not obviously the same equal as they are, as you do right this moment now in this era. So I think he saw it as like escapism, and you get to, you know, have imagination where you don't actually get with reality. So I think he loved the theatre a lot. So he obviously loved like the circus, where Great Expectations, when he wrote that was heavy influence with a lot of, you know, with a lot of pantomime plays and the circus. And I think one of his family members actually gave him a toy theater. So he got to play and actually physically, you know, perform with his hands and actually have that imagination of what could be, you know, different scenes. And I think that was, I feel, why he wrote that particular scene with the Crummies actors troupe is, you know, he's really loved the theatre. I think he tries to make everyone, whoever reads his plays, see the theatre as such an amazing community and a relationship as well to it.
That's such an interesting point, that in a world which is so horrible, the one thing that's the nice thing that is an escapism from that temporarily is the theatre.
Yeah, absolutely. And a bit of comedy as well. And like, did you know, a lot of like Nicholas Nickleby is such a, you know, a horrific, dark, you know, with dark, horrible events that happens in Yorkshire. So I think he needed something lighthearted to show, you know, uplift it as well. Because it's just the beginning of the scene. It's just so much pain. Like, he lost his father. Next minute he gets sent to Yorkshire. Kate goes through, you know, being a dressmaker, but then she goes through so much torment as well, being bullied. I think, and also him having Smike, so they needed something, you know, to uplift the reader, especially, and the audience, because I think you have so much pain, like Hamlet, for example. It's just like, it's so much heartache. You just need something to change the emotions of the reader and actually just, you know, go through an adventure with them, especially Nicholas Nickleby.
I do love that about Dickens, that even though the stories tend to be quite bleak, they're always so humorous. There's always this very witty undertone constantly.
Who are both of your favourite characters in the story?
I think my favourite character it's so hard because there's so many good characters in there. I kind of really enjoyed the twin brothers. I can't remember their name. It's annoying.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah, they're amazing.
They're like the honest up. They're the, like the standard, gold standard of what a human being should be, aren't they?
Exactly. And took Nicholas straight away under their wing. Like, you know what? I don't care what you guys say. You know, especially when his uncle was like, oh, Nicholas is a terrible, terrible, you know, nephew. And he's like, well, I actually think he's a good person. So they go by their own judgment first before, you know, judging Nicholas by other people, what they think of him.
Brilliant.
How about yourself?
I like Mrs. Nickleby because she's meant to be based on Dickens's own mother. And she, apparently when Dickens's mother read it, she was like, oh, well, nobody would believe this character. She's so unrealistic because she didn't even recognize herself in the writing. I find normally when you meet somebody who is similar to yourself in real life, you don't like them. I don't know what it is. He's like almost every time I've met somebody who's just like me, I'm always like, don't like them. And then my husband or my friends will be like, they're just like you. And I'm like, oh no.
Because yeah. you recognize all of your things that you don't like about yourself. Yeah. My favorite character, I the first time I ever watched Nicholas Nickleby, and then when I read it, I felt this real emotional connection, and I don't know why, but protection over Smike in this way that was just, I don't know, that nearly made me cry. I just found the character so lovable, and I found the situation that he was in so horrific, and I found that really powerful. So he's without doubt my favorite character, I think.
You do give your heart to him, don't you?
Well, thank you so much for coming on our podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure having you as our guest.
No problem. Thank you so much for inviting me. You know, really appreciate it. Really enjoyable, really fun. Nicholas Nickleby.
Huge thanks to Lisa for joining us on that one. So this is the part of the podcast where we talk about where you can watch it or read it or listen to it. I'm going to go ahead and say read it. I think this is a really enjoyable book to read. I know it doesn't sound like it, but it really is. I think definitely give it a read. The descriptions are stunning as always, and the humour is great, and yeah.
Yeah, you know what? I agree with you. I actually would say to people, first thing you should do is read it, because you emotionally connect to it. It's so, you feel enraptured in it, I think. And there's a lot of audiobooks that you can listen to online. There are also two films you can watch. There is a 2001 film with Charlie Hunnam, which I think has people like Edward Fox in, and Jamie Bell plays Smike. That's available online. There's a film which I think is excellent, which is a 2002 film, which has Charles Dance. He's playing Ralph Nickleby, and it's like a wonderful cast. Actually, Tom Hiddleston's first on-screen performance. He plays one of the mates of the Dominic West character, who's the one who forces himself on Nicholas Nickleby's sister. So that's a very, very good film adaptation as well.
There is also on the podcast app that, if you have an iPhone, the entire book, again, you can just listen to it episodically. The life and adventures of Nicholas Nickleby, it's all there for you to listen to for free. So if reading's not your thing and watching's not your thing, and you're working at your computer and you're listening to this podcast right now and you're thinking, that one sounds like the one that I'm going to give a go at, you can always listen to it and have it playing in the background.
Yeah, exactly. Or just go to Yorkshire. I think it's a very unfair portrait of Yorkshire, because I was at university in Yorkshire and it's a very friendly place and everyone is lovely. So I don't think it paints Yorkshire necessarily in the best light, but go and do some research.
I do quite like that at the beginning of the book, there's like a little foreword written by Charles Dickens where he says that the schools there are so appalling, you wouldn't even send your horse or dog to live in those conditions.
Oh God. That's so nuts. I'm going to read that. I haven't read that that forward. Clearly it's terrible. It's a great story, and it's an interesting one, how it's very geographical, isn't it? They yo-yo around the country quite a lot. There's a lot of jumping around Yorkshire, Devonshire, Portsmouth, London, everywhere. A lot of coach fares, I think, on Nicholas Nickleby. But very, very good. And yeah, great fun.
You can let us know your thoughts on this. You can find us on Twitter at InQuarantinePod. And you can also follow us on Instagram, where we will be having little segments of our interviews and funny little memes for you to catch up on. And that is also InQuarantine_pod.
Speaking of which, so we asked you on Twitter, which Dickens character would you most want to spend lockdown with? And we got some great answers. We got Betsy Trotwood and Esther Summerson would make intelligent and sensible companions. Micawber, good punch-making skills. Little Nell, please just stay at home and avoid your awful fate. We got a great one, which was, I'd stay with Mr. Brownlow in Pentonville, books from the bookstall. Grimwig would be in our bubble, so he could come over and hang.
There was somebody who said that they would stay with the Cratchits because they'd be really good cooks, but they probably don't have enough food. So,
that's
a lack of food to provide.
Yes, I think that's right. Although having said that, I think that one is my favourite because they also say in that, I completely agree, the cooking would not be sufficient. You'd have to get a few Uber Eats, I think. But they also said, because they sustain good cheer in the midst of difficulty. And I think we all need a bit of Cratchit loving at the moment. So I think for that reason alone, I'd go with the Cratchits, but not for the cooking.
Yeah, I agree. I'll go to the Cratchits too, but I'll bring my own turkey along. I'll be the Scrooge for the day.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week to talk about Little Dorrit. So if you want to get a head start on that before the episode is out, please feel free to listen and then tweet us and criticize us. Thank you so much.
Take care, guys. Stay safe.
Bye.